I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Medina, Superintendent, Head of Grounds.
Director of Golf Course Operations, to be specific.
Director of Golf Course Operations, Curtis Tyrell. Curtis, welcome on.
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, I've been meaning to do this. I think you got a very interesting story. You've got a diverse background between multiple renovations out here, multiple major events, you manage one of the biggest golf facilities that's in the United States. And I think a great way to start would be, like, how'd you get here?
Oh yeah, it's been a wild ride. I'm originally from Maryland, and I graduated from Elon University in North Carolina with a degree in history. And I had worked on the golf courses, through high school and college a couple of summers. But when I got out of college, I went back home. And I was thinking about going to grad school for history and went back to work on the golf course while I was figuring that out. And fell in love with it, because once we got through the summer and I graduated from a weed eater to something a little bit more important, and realized, really more of the inner workings of golf course maintenance and agronomy, through just a fantastic mentor by the name of Mike Evans, back at the Country Club of Woodmore in Mitchellville, Maryland, I fell in love with it.
Was that Woodmont?
That was Woodmont. It's Woodmont. Not too far away. But a couple years later, I went back to Penn State and enrolled in their two-year turf grass management program. And then, just took off. I felt, obviously I said already, I fell in love with it. I mean, it was just Penn State was a great environment, really competitive. Mm-hmm. In the early 90s when I was there, there was 24 kids in our class, and Michigan State had a big class, and it was really, a hot career path and things. So you had to, to compete. Plus, being at a place like Penn State, you felt like a star basketball recruit in high school. I mean, you had Augusta National, Cypress Point, Cherry Hills, Marion, all these clubs wanted you to come work there. Mm-hmm. And it was like, man, I just felt like, this is incredible. It felt like a big cheese, and had just a great experience there. Did my internship at Cherry Hills in Colorado. And that experience of kind of getting off the East Coast, out West, learning a ton about golf out there, ton about golf courses out there, really solidified my bug to kind of travel with the industry. And that was something I really liked about it. At the time, I mean, golf was getting built all over the world, and I saw it as a way to see the world and do something I love. Yes. And so when I graduated, I went out to work for my mentor, Mike Evans, his mentor, a guy by the name of Virgil Robinson at PGA West in La Quinta, California. And at the time, they had just finished the fifth course there, and I think there's eight there now. Which was the Weisskopf course. So I went out there as an assistant superintendent and worked on the Weisskopf private, the Nicklaus private, the Palmer private, did a little bit of time on the Stadium Resort course, and kind of worked around that property for a year when there was some change in ownership, and Virgil moved on. And I had the opportunity to move to Desert Mountain in Scottsdale. And I was eager to do that. I knew a little bit about that facility from being out West. And I knew they had a senior major, the Tradition. And they were building golf courses. And the guy that I was going to go work for by the name of Sean Emerson, who is in my role there, he's a director of agronomy there, and he's still there today. He was somebody that I really was learning a ton from and was eager to learn more from. So, you know, I jumped over there and spent 3 years and working there and kind of moving up the ranks from assistant to course superintendent there. Mm-hmm. And we did three traditions, built the Chiricahua course, rebuilt all the greens on the Geronimo course and the Cochise course while I was there. And that's when I got my first taste of golf course construction. And at the time, we were a four went to five courses. So a multiple course facility, golf course construction, tournament experience, desert agronomy, you know, cool season grasses, warm season grasses. I mean, it was awesome. And, you know, it was just a wonderful experience. And after 3 years, I got a job in Vegas. Okay. And I went up to Anthem Country Club.
Man, all over the place.
Yeah, no, it was
desert,
a wild
ride. Desert, right in the desert for a while.
Yeah, I was. I know. I mean, when I was out there, I was like, I couldn't wait to get out of there because it was so hot every summer. And I just kept saying, I'm never going to do another summer in the desert. And they just kept coming. You know, I couldn't get out of there. But they were all great experiences. And Anthem was a Keith Foster designed 18-hole mm-hmm. private club, which was owned by a developer. And when they sold out the community, they sold the club to another developer who brought in Troon Golf. And so about halfway through my time there, Troon Golf came in and was overseeing the management of it. And at that time, they were just growing like crazy. And in their portfolio, they were picking up some really great facilities. And I expressed my interest to want to get back to the East Coast where I'm from. My wife's from New England, had gotten married through my time in the desert, and one day they called me up, and we had a lot of success in Anthem and had won some awards within the organization, and they called me up and said, how would you like to go build 36 holes in Connecticut with Reese Jones? And I'm like, of course, like, when do we go? You know, and they're like, well, actually, you know, can you be there Friday and meet the owners? And I'm like, okay. So I flew out to Lake of Isles, which is a new property that was about to be built in southeastern Connecticut, right next to Long Island Sound. And it was associated with the Foxwoods Casino. And so it was owned by the Native American tribe that ran that casino. And they're about to build this 36-hole facility around a 90-acre lake on an old Boy Scout camp. And we were looking at 2 years of construction and working with Reese. And so ultimately the owner...
That was Reese's heyday.
Oh, it was. Yeah. Yeah. It was.
He was turning and burning then.
He was turning and burning. And, you know, so I got that job and went over there. And I mean, I was there when we cut the first tree out of there and carved these two golf courses over 2 years. I mean, 2 years with no golfers building two golf courses. I mean, it was like superintendent's dream, you know? I mean, we were just having a ball. And it was a big project, a lot of infrastructure, a ton of ledge. I've never been around ever since before then or since then, so much dynamite. I mean, we blasted more rock to build those golf courses. And, you know, it was really an engineering and golf course construction feat. And Reese laid out.
Casino money.
And, you know, not a single hole on it. You can't see one hole from the next. You know, this classic, you know, that era's classic, you know, golf course that winds through the woods and you're really out there on your own. And Reese just did a fantastic job. Two championship designs up there. And, you know, loved it. Stayed on. We opened it up, managed it for 3 years after we finished building it. And then one day I got a call from a firm that was looking for to place somebody in this position here. And, you know, that was another call, kind of like, hey, what do you think about Medina Country Club? You know, they're going to hold the Ryder Cup and they want to do some work to their courses. And I'm like, you know, let's go. You know, I was super excited. And so I interviewed for the position and got it. And, you know, it was a... you know, big moment in my life, man. I was super pumped, you know, to come to a place like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a heck of a facility.
Yeah.
Not many bigger than this one. And I mean, the rounds per year are just huge. And I mean, it's three drastically different golf courses now too, which we'll get to. Curious with your experience at Lake of the Isles. How, like, seeing it grow in for 3 years, I mean, you're there five total,
right? Yeah, right.
I'm always wondering about like maturation and like, you know, like how long, you know, should somebody like really give a course to really take a hold of its like, you know, true identity? Is it 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 1 year, like, you know, or do you not even know?
You know what? Oh man, it really depends on the site and any specific conditions that are going on there, and then the business model. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if this place is going to get played aggressively, it's going to mature differently than one that isn't. And you know, in some cases, it could force the maturation to come forward sooner, mm-hmm. right? Because you got to make certain adjustments and perform certain practices to be able to handle all that traffic. But you know, I think in general, you know at least people always said it's about 3 years, and I think that is definitely a good benchmark in time. I mean, the day that you open the golf course, I mean, let's just say that you were given enough time to grow it in, and like here are these projects that we did, we used basically a full calendar year from the time we planted them to the time we opened them, roughly. Mm-hmm. A little less in some holes than others, but you're given enough time to grow it in. I mean, it's really sharp when you open it up. But there's a real specific time frame that is the construction maintenance activities to the maintenance activities of operating it, where you learn a ton. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see your mower wear, you see your cart and player wear, you see irrigation challenges and adjustments, you see drainage issues, which, you know, last forever. You know, you start to learn more about the impacts of shade and other things, air movement. So, I mean, there's a period of time, that first year to year and a half, where you're learning a lot. Mm-hmm. And you got to be really attentive. And you can't take your eye off the ball, or all of a sudden, you know, stuff just thins out on you. Or, you know, next thing you know, you got issues. But if you're looking for that, and you treat it in a spot-specific way, and you expect to have to find these things, you can get in front of them, then, you know, year and a half, you've found all those, you've adjusted your maintenance accordingly, and next thing you know, the turf has settled down, and you're working more on that periphery tie-in stuff that really, I think, is what most people disregard in terms of the maturation. I mean, the turf is really high quality all the time, and like I said, you got to learn how to maintain it, but it's that periphery stuff, the tie-in things that need time to mature and really bring the whole course together.
I mean, the small little details are like the things that seem, I might look at courses a little bit different than your average Joe, but like, you know, the walks from tees to greens, the transitions, the rough lines and the cut lines, like those little small details, like the bunker lines, the, you know, the mow into the bunker lines, like that's the thing. I mean, course two, the newly restored course two, like, the way you guys have the fairways cut into the bunkers and the edges around the greens they're incredible. So in terms of, you know, is it frustrating? Because I feel like, you know, everybody wants to push, especially with new courses, and using Medina as an example, I bet members are chomping at the bit to get out there because they can see it, and they're, right. You know, like, how hard is it to keep them at bay?
Well, it's tough. There's a lot of pressure. And, you know, for us here at Medina, we learned the hard way. So, you know, the course three project, while I was new and I outlined what I felt like we needed, you know, there was pressure, and we caved a little bit, and we got out there too soon, and it made the grow in a little longer than it needed to be because we were running a ton of rounds through it. And it was more challenging, but learning from that experience, both the mm-hmm. members and me, on how to manage and guide the members on that regard. In the second project, we stuck firm with what we knew we needed, and it really came out significantly different than the first one. And so by the time we got to course two, everybody was on board. You know, there's no more convincing on the amount of time that we needed and the right way to do it, and from everything from scope, you know, construction scope and grow in scope to time required, we were all on the same page, and it's worked out real well.
So with the, you know, three separate projects, as you've, you know, grown here and you've become more familiar with the membership and they become more familiar with you, how much has your role changed, like when, you know, you're planning these things out, and, you know, whether it be interviewing architects or you know, looking at the plans and figuring out timelines, like how much has it changed from when you were the new guy to, you know, most recently, you know, to when you, so you did three then to number two, to number one with Tom Doak, and then to number two again with Reese. And, you know, I know you were like heavily involved in the Greens Committee, was heavily involved with that, but, you know, like how's the kind of the role and the change? This is the longest question of all time.
No, I hear you. I mean, you know, what's interesting about that question is that my role has really been the same from the beginning, mm-hmm. but their confidence level in me has grown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when I got here, you know, the leaders of the club at that time, you know, were very specific on wanting to take on these projects and needing an expert with the experience to both run a multi-course facility, prep for a big tournament, but also develop and manage and execute these projects. And so they empowered me right from the start. Now, obviously, what I was bringing to the club was all kinds of new stuff. You know, like their idea of what they wanted to do, and then me effectively translating that into terms they could understand, and time frames, and dollars, and all these things. That was the hard part. Was explaining to that to them, and making that clear, and because it wasn't necessarily what they expected.
Yeah.
But you know, what's been great is they've continued to put their confidence in me and allow me to lead really on those projects, and they've just gotten easier. You know, I mean, like going back to the, you know, Reese was already you know, here and working with Medina for a long time when I arrived. But when we went with looking for somebody to do course one, you know, that was my role to assemble different people, to reach out to the various architects out there that they wanted to talk to, set up the meetings, bring the engineers in, make sure that those two parties could collaborate, get the permitting process going. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's a unique process. And I've been very fortunate to work for the members of Medina, and very blessed to have their confidence to be able to do it. Yeah. It's been a really great experience.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think anybody that knows a little bit about architects would say that Reese and Tom are on a little bit on the other ends of the spectrum. So what's it like to, you know, work with each of them, you know, and what are the, you know, the differences? And then is there anything that they do similar? And, you know, kind of what have you learned from each of them?
You know, what's funny, Andy, is I've been waiting for somebody to ask me that question. I've had a lot of different interviews or, you know, conversations, and nobody is, and I've been waiting for that question and trying to prepare for it for many years.
I have to ask.
It's a great question. You know, what's interesting is that they are very different people, personality wise, but they are both, when you understand that they're both world class, top tier golf course architects, you start to understand the similarities. And what I mean is the way they approach a project. Like, I mean, Tom's approach to a project and his finished product is completely different necessarily than Reese's finished product. But, you know, they both have to work through the same pathway of logistics, practicality, engineering, floodplain, you know, drainage, all these things. They're all on the same plate for each of these guys, mm-hmm. right? So they both have their way of working through those to get to the end result. And it's interesting to see, you know, how they do it. You know, Reese, I've known Reese for many years yeah. now, and I consider him a friend and a mentor, and he's really took me under his wing at the Lake of Isles and taught me, you know, everything that I know to get started. Mm-hmm. And then when I met Tom, it really just opened my eyes to, you know, just somebody that was completely different personality-wise, but and stylistically, artistically, what he would create, you know, and watching what he did out there, you know, really blew my mind and opened it to a whole new level of architecture. And I think it really helped. Those experiences really helped me play my role when it came to the two project. But You know, they both really respect each other. Reese coming from a completely different era and a different kind of way up the line than Tom. But like I said, you know, managing them as partners and as knowing them as people, you know, they're both world class, and it's really been great for Medina to have both of those guys have such great products out here.
It's, I mean, like completely different philosophies of design and then also just the way it's implemented.
Yeah.
But both of them, you know, you can't, the client satisfaction and the, you know, the true professionals of like architecture, like, true. You know, where they, you know, versus if you went with like a younger architect, like the logistics stuff, probably not as smooth.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, so Reese is a design contract guy.
Yeah.
In your role, what are kind of the benefits of the design contract and the benefits of design build? Like, would you prefer one over the other? Did you learn more from one or the other? Or, you know, you've been in more design contract situations, but right. I'm kind of curious, you know, looking at each philosophy, you know, there is kind of a...
Yeah.
Schism in architecture with these two philosophies as design builds become so much more popular. I'm curious, having seen both in action, what the...
Sure, sure. You know, and I think just to go back before I dive into that one too, you know, I don't think Reese gets enough credit in today's critiques of architects for his management and use of the land. You know, I think he gets classified into a group of architects that came up through that era of mass building. You know, when they were in business and they just had so many projects and it had to be contract and there was this engineering and land planner routings and all these things. And I think you know, he's kind of put in that bucket. But yet, you know, I mean, he's looking at it from the most practical standpoint and the most minimalistic standpoint that he can as well. You know, people just think that they think, oh, I'm just going to bulldoze all this and move all this over here. Or, you know, you get that sense that people don't appreciate his ability to see it that way. Whereas Tom, man, I mean, you think about this, the places and what he's done and the sites that he's worked with, you know, he's come up and really rode his own pathway. I mean, he's carved his own niche to become who he is, which is one of the most regarded. And so, you know, it's two totally different roads to the end, but if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm rambling, but
no.
But you know, when we did course one with Tom, it was a hybrid of the contract design build. So Brian Schneider was on site, and Brian shaped all of the key features, so the greens, bunkers. But we also had Wadsworth Golf on site, and they did a lot of the mass earth moving. And what I mean is, one third of that project was storm drainage and floodplain improvements. So we had a lot of cuts, we had a lot of pipe going in to get water off that place. I mean, this is a 4 square mile watershed that when it was originally built was all farms, and now it's all urban.
Yeah.
And so I mean, there's just a ton of water moving through here, and we're expected to hold a certain amount, you know, for the county and how everything works. And we needed to accentuate and improve that. So we needed somebody to help cut and move a lot of dirt. So there was a real hybrid of that design build. But I tell you what, I really like that way of doing it. I mean, Brian and Eric Iverson, who was also here for a little bit, as well as a couple other guys that Tom had circle through here for a period of time, watching their approach to it and watching their abilities was that part that really just, you know, I think kind of blew the door wide open. You know, with Reese, you know, at the Lake of Isles, he had these plans, and Steve Weiser and Bryce Swanson, they'd come up and they'd come up as often as they could, and considering where they lived in close to that project, they were up a lot, and so that was great. I got to learn a lot. But they'd leave, and they'd kind of, after we got comfortable with each other, they'd leave it to me to make sure that when they got back, it was done a certain way.
Yeah.
So it was my job to kind of work with those shapers and say, closer to the green with this bunker, flash this higher, this needs to roll more. You know, so I was over there massaging what they were doing based on their direction. And, you know, that was interesting because we had freelance contractors working through a major golf course contractor out of Montreal, and they all spoke French. And, I mean, it was just a wild deal. Moving over here to Wadsworth, you know, I've gotten to know their team, and they've done all our work here, and they've got some fantastic shapers in their own right, and they are they're really flexible and pretty damn good. I mean, it took a little while on two to get them to come out of their comfort zone because they're so used to kind of mass building according to plans, and then I'd have to teach them that, hey, just because, you know, on 10 out of 11 projects you've done it like this, forget it. I want that whole ledge cut down and I want to be able to see through it. It's totally different. But once I got them to understand that, boy, they'd shape it out perfectly. And
they get a lot of reps.
They get a lot of reps. And they've got a lot in their repertoire, but they need, if somebody's not there to direct them to be different, they're going to kind of build that standard template. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what we did, was we got them to break out of that mold on course two and shape completely different than they normally did. And so Reese's involvement and Steve's involvement, you know, was just the same, where we'd talk about what it would look like, and then I would make sure that, you know, it was getting built that way. Uh-huh. Whereas with Tom, you know, Tom and Brian, Tom would come up, Brian would build it.
You know,
they'd talk about it, and Brian would make all the subtle things. And then as Wadsworth came in to kind of prep it for finishing and my crew would come in to seed it, you know, Brian would be there looking over our shoulder to make sure we didn't take anything out, essentially. You know, I mean, he had it the way he wanted it. So in the finishing process, don't lose that ridge. Don't soften that roll. You know, so it was really cool and definitely different. But I mean, it's just a lot of fun to be able to build things the way Brian and Eric and Tom's guys can build. And if I were to ever do something like that, I would probably follow that direction and try to do it. Or hire some old Wadsworth guys to work with me and help me.
Yeah, start your own firm.
Yeah, because they're really good.
It seems to me, when I look at it, all parties are more aligned that way.
Yeah.
Because there's no competing interest. It also seems like for the club, you've got one direct path. There's never, something I've always wondered, like, have you ever had a situation in your experience where, like, whether even be back at Desert Mountain, like, where the contractor, the designer, and the club, like, you know, there was like a struggle with communication? Or is it usually pretty clear right from the get-go, and like it's never been a big problem?
Yeah, you know what, at Desert Mountain, it was Jack Nicholson. He built all those courses, and so he would come out and whatever he said went, you know what I mean? It was never a struggle there, and that was you know, interesting and fun to get in the back of a pickup truck with Jack Nicholson, ride the site. You know, I didn't say a word, I just listened. Yeah. You know, but you know, it, what he said went there. And Lake of Isles was really from the ground up. So, you know, Reese had full artistic control. I mean, he did have a budget and a project managers and things that he was accountable to. And we did run into issues, like I said, with rock and dynamite, things that were big dollar things. But Reese is, you know, very, you know, creative and good at that kind of stuff. And he managed all that. Here, you know, the membership, from the very first day, the president of the club that hired me 10 years ago was a man by the name of John Potts. And he was adamant, and to this day is the same guy, and in that, hey, well, I'm going to hire the best people, and I'm going to empower them to do the job, and I'm going to get out of the way. And he held that line.
It's a good manager.
Yeah, exactly. And he held that line in it. And I'm happy to say that remained consistent as others followed him. through the board and through the Green Committee, and you know, we've had really, I mean, both the architects have always wanted to hear from the membership, and the membership's had their chance to provide their input or give their opinions, but it's kind of always been at the beginning as the plan's being developed, the concepts are being reviewed. You know, they want to hear what the customer wants, and then but when it came down to it, and I bet you if you asked Tom, he'd tell you how surprised he was in the end that they let him do whatever he wanted. And I remember when we were trying to get the design out of him, you know, the final one for review, you know, he and Reese both were kind of, you know, like, are you sure? And I'm like, look, if you want to blow it up, blow it up. They want to see that. They want to see what you think, not what you think they want. They want to see what you think. That's what they're looking to get. And Tom was like, you got to be kidding me, you know, in his own way. You know, like, you got to be kidding me. He took him a while to, I think, trust me that I was telling the truth as I liaisoned this information and encouraged him to do it. But he did it, and it held true all the way through. And so that credit goes to the members of Medina. You know, they went out and they found the people they wanted, the best people that they could get, and they empowered them to build it. And now they've got those products out there, which, you know, is a testament to them and their commitment. So.
I think that's like really good advice for any membership or any Greens committee is letting, like, you know, when you get to a planning stage and an architect putting together plans, like, you know, let them put everything they want to do out there.
Yeah.
Because like they might have something that's spectacular that they hold back on because they're afraid, but like letting them put everything out there.
Right.
You know, you can always rein something back in, but like you won't see the full thought, because they're, you know, they're really artists and
for sure. And you have to do that too from an infrastructure structural standpoint, because the art won't manifest completely if it doesn't function properly. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what people run into is they have this set budget before they even start, right? And we faced that at the beginning, like, hey, we're only going to spend this much on the project. Well, okay. But our philosophy was, we're going to tell the membership what it costs to do it right.
Right. Yeah.
And it happened to be more than double on that project. And everybody was concerned, and we talked about it, but we all agreed that, hey, let's give them the full project and let them say no. Mm-hmm. And we gave them the project, we gave them the backup, and they said yes, and we built it, and it worked. So, you know, I mean, if you're fortunate enough to be able to take the time to do it that way, that's the way to do it. This whole value engineering before you even go ask for the money is just a road to shortcuts and disasters.
How does maintenance and golf course, like just the overall philosophy and trends, changed in the last 15 years for the industry?
You know, that's a good question. They've definitely continued to progress, and I would say most of it has been around the development of a lot of the new grasses that guys are using. Whether it's warm season or cool season grasses, everybody's using modern, you know, varieties and species that happen to be high organic matter producers, right? So we're all trying to get the firmest, fastest product that we can get.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a little different, right?
That's definitely different. Yeah. But we're trying to do that with these grasses that are inclined to get there, but what people don't see is what happens under the canopy, under the surface, and inadvertently it requires a lot of maintenance that people haven't really counted on. So that's been a change. You know, coming up from the desert there 7 years, you know, I was taught a real irrigation was a premium. You know, I learned to manage head by head. I learned not to waste a drop of water. I learned to water very specific and effectively. And I've used those principles through my East Coast work, my Midwest work, you know, my Southern work. So, I mean, it's all been there with this firm and fast approach and water conservation and all the things that come into today's golf course maintenance environment. Managing irrigation and understanding water quality and making it work for you for as little as possible ultimately yields that playing surface people are looking like and addresses the environmental concerns. And really what it comes down to is, it's funny, is that it's really about the fundamental principles of cultivation and soil modification and or drainage, right? You've got to have a draining profile. You can't have heavy soils that hold water. You got to remove the organic matter. If you do all that, you can use the least amount of water. You can keep it firm. You can do all these things. You know, as painful as that is to take a golf course out of play and execute that, it's critical, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. It's with the new courses, you get the new greens, and they don't have any, like, thatch in them.
Right.
What's the best year to put, like, because I know, like, no thatch, people will be like, it's way too firm.
Right.
Is it, like, year two when they're just perfect?
You know what? With these newer grasses, like, we have 007 creeping bent grass on our greens here at Medina. And, yeah, it's literally end of the second year, beginning of the third year, yeah, when we need to now start removing it. Uh-huh. So somewhere in that second year, start of the third, you've got the right amount.
Yeah.
And if you don't get on it then in terms of the management of that profile, it'd get away from you quick.
Yeah.
So it comes on a lot faster than it may have in the past, but you also have to stay, from a management perspective, equally as on top of it as quick as it comes on you.
Yeah, so I played a couple courses last year, the Loop and then Sand Valley, first year, and, you know, yeah, greens are really firm. And, like, yeah, I love firm. I mean, I kind of like it. I kind of like playing new courses because it brings a whole new element to the game. But
sure,
I played them both this year, and, like, I thought they were so close to perfect where, like, you really, you know, like, long irons really run out. And it's amazing how much of a difference that mm-hmm. makes
right.
on, like, the overall strategy of a golf course. Mm-hmm. And you see it on the tour. I mean, like, if a course isn't firm and fast, it doesn't matter what course it is. It's going to get lit up by these guys. And,
that's right.
And then, like, you know, you saw, like, I think TPC Potomac, they their superintendent did a great job this year, but it was so firm and fast, and the scores were right around par. Mm-hmm. And, it makes a big difference. And then I think firm and fast conditions are something that almost levels that skill difference between the low handicappers and the high handicappers, because for seniors, they get the ball gets run in and the course right. isn't as long. But right. then for the more skilled player, it heightens how precise you have to be.
Yeah.
You know, the ball just doesn't stick no matter how you hit it.
That's
you
right.
It's,
yeah.
It's cool. How do you go about managing three courses? Not many superintendents have as big of an operation as you. You know, what's the difference between being, you know, superintendent at, you know, Billy Bob Country Club and, you know, having a team and having to manage three? Like, how much time do you spend across them?
Yeah, so you said it starts with the team, really. You know, you've got to have a team of individuals, both at the top level of your management in terms of your course superintendents and your assistants, and then all the way down to your seasonal guys. But you have to build a very well-qualified, eager, kind of hungry team that likes high energy and a lot of action, right? At three courses, there's just always something happening. You're always, you know, you might be on this course, but there might be something happening over there and one of the others, and you just have to be, ready for a fast-paced kind of environment, and then you got to be communicative. I mean, mm-hmm. we place a real big premium on communication here, and you know, if you look through our shop, I have, you know, things all over the wall that talk about, like, fundamental communication and talking as frequently as possible, and it's a major part of our day just to have that radio blaring back and forth, even though you're just sending information back and forth, in order for everybody to be engaged. And that's what it takes to be successful at running a consistent large-scale operation, is, you know, a really qualified, hungry group of people and guys that are willing to communicate. I mean, if you come work on our team and you sit back and you don't engage, you're going to get passed by and you will just be out of the game. You know, you've got to be willing to ask the dumb question, to make the odd or irrelevant observation. It doesn't matter. It's communication. It engages you into the talk. We all get going, and that's really the key to it. And then, you know, obviously, I mean, you got to have the resources and the support of the club, and you got to have real specific goals for what yeah. you're trying to accomplish. And that has everything to do with the customer, right? So, I mean, you know, you and I might like really firm, fast conditions, but the Medina members may like, to them, that might be something different. And, and you got to have a clear picture of that to set those goals right. But, you know, here at Medina, we are fortunate to have, I'm fortunate to be the leader of just a fantastic group of guys. Jake Mendoza, our course three superintendent, has been with me for 3 years and or for 10 years. And he's worked on all three courses. And Dane Wilson, the course two superintendent, he started as an intern here with us some 7-8 years ago and has worked his way all the way up to course superintendent. He oversaw the course two project along with me. He also worked on the Doak project, so he's got a ton of experience. And he's a legacy soup. His dad was superintendent of Valhalla for 23 years, so he's got a...
It's in his blood.
It's in his blood. And Chris Funke, our course one superintendent, also interned for me a number of years ago, came back after he graduated and worked his way up to running one of the golf courses. And then our assistants and our full-time staff, guys that have been at Medina for 15, 18, 20 years. I mean, these guys, they know the deal, and we count on them heavily, and they deliver. And, you know, it's a privilege for me to be a part of the that group. The internship program I mentioned briefly is a big deal to me. We just completed our 10th season, and there's 8 of us that are university-trained agronomists that manage the property. And take me out of it, of the 7, of the 7, 5 of them were interns in our program that have come back to work their way up. So, I mean, I'm really proud that, that they get that kind of experience as a student. They see a place where they can grow and learn a lot of stuff and obviously work at a great place. They come back, they work hard, and then we've had guys graduate on out of our program and in various parts of the country now at top facilities. So I place a real emphasis on developing my team. I put a lot of work and effort into making sure they get what they need and it's custom to their goals. And ultimately that pays off benefits for our members because everybody's on the same page.
I mean, it's cool because you give them place to grow, and you know, eventually you hope they grow out.
That's
I mean, it's what every manager should want. And it's kind of, you know, Doak has a similar internship program with Renaissance
he
Design,
does, yes.
Like where, you know, they have the internship program. You can look and you see all these new young architects are, you know, come from there, or Corin Crenshaw, and it's internships. It's cool when you can see them, you know, you've got like a coaching tree. You're like Coach K.
Yeah.
You
know, it's funny you say that because we have a lot of Coach K things on the wall. And, you know, my mentor, Sean Emerson at Desert Mountain, he's a fiery guy. And I loved working for him because of that. But he would call himself the Bobby Knight of golf course superintendents. And I always used to tell him, one day I'm going to be the Coach K, because Coach K worked for Bobby Knight.
Yeah.
And
both Army guys.
Yeah, and Coach K, I think, has a few more national championships than Bobby Knight. So I like to rub that into Sean. But I don't think I had more than him. But it was always fun to just kind of smack talk like that.
Yeah. Curious. So national championships.
Yeah.
Good segue.
Yeah.
You've hosted PGA. No, you weren't here for the
PGA. I wasn't here for the PGA.
So you got Ryder Cup.
Ryder Cup.
And then you'll have the BMW in 2 years.
Right.
So Ryder Cup, I mean, that had to be...
once-in-a-lifetime experience. It was unbelievable.
I was out here.
Yeah.
I'm walking in here on the course.
Yeah.
Just parking lot.
I tell you what, I mean, from the day I was hired until the day after the Ryder Cup.
How long before the Ryder Cup were you
hired? 5 years.
5 years.
5 years. And every day for 5 years, Andy, all I thought about was that week. I mean, there wasn't a single day that I didn't come out on this property and think about that week. You know, I mean, it was 100. I mean, that was the main draw. That's what I wanted to do. It was a goal of mine to do something like that. And I tell you, it was quite a humbling experience driving up the 18th fairway on Sunday when we had prepped our last hole, and then driving the course the next morning was like, you know, I was in just a weird place, you know, that 5 years of time that I lived to try to successfully lead the team through that, and we had accomplished it. It was something else. But
you're one of the few Americans that had a good feeling after that Ryder Cup.
That's true. That's true. And I had so many guys from Europe and other volunteers here, you know, wanting to console me that afternoon. And I was, like, trying to act sad. But at the same time, I mean, I was just so happy that Medina was successful. I mean, that was what my goal was. And that was what I was here to do, was to ensure that that golf course and this club showed well, and that our members were proud, and that was first and foremost, and we accomplished that.
The U.S. Open's kind of the only thing that comes close to the spectacle of a Ryder Cup in terms of, like, years of preparation. There had to be, you know, so every Ryder Cup, because of the alternating schedule, I mean, for 4 years,
right,
you're essentially, like, the PGA's sole focus.
Yeah.
I mean, right. It's a big deal for them. So how often would you communicate and, you know?
You know, I started talking with Kerry Haig of the PGA when the Ryder Cup was at Valhalla. Mm-hmm. And
Did you go down to that then?
I did. Uh-huh. I did. I went down there, you know, a number of times to see the build out and down during the event. But Kerry and his team was on site literally the winter after that, walking the site, starting to lay out the design of the production, if you will, and so, you know, there was a lot of talk, and then it really heated up when the captain was selected. So that was 2 years, you know, just under 2 years prior to the event, and that's when the talks got a little bit more specific. The plans were all laid out in terms of corporate hospitality layout, back of the house staging, grandstands. You know, we had a plan that we were working off of, and in terms of inside the ropes, you know, then we started having discussions like
home field setup.
What's the goal? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So what was the goal for that Ryder Cup? Like, what was, like, kind of, you know, how do they want the course? Like, what, you know, did they talk about, like, what would, you know, be benefit?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so Paul Azinger at Valhalla, he was, like, the first American in a long time, American captain in a long time, to have some influence and do some things. So, you know, they mowed some rough short in some landing zones and, you know, cut down a tree limb that was in the way of J.B. Holmes. And, you know, they did a few things where he was, you know, as opposed to previous guys that hadn't really done anything except show up to play and coach. So Davis, you know, kind of coming off that, I mean, he was in tune to, hey, I'm going to have some influence. So, you know, Kerry and Davis and I sat down, and they both were in agreement that they wanted short rough, or they thought they wanted short rough, and they wanted fast green. So that's where it all started. So that following summer, the summer of 11, I said, okay, and I went out, and we developed a plan, the team and I, and the superintendent of course three at the time was a guy by the name of Ross Lobsher, who we have a long history and had worked together, and I had brought him here to be a part of that because, you know, we had, you know, I had a ton of confidence in him, and he was on that project, and he's now at Entrada at Snow Canyon in Utah. Anyway, we all sat down and came up with this plan about how to drape the entire golf course in intermediate height rough. So we were going to mow it down, interseed it, start using growth regulators to create density, and try to build fairways essentially at an inch and a quarter that went completely over top of and around all green complexes, all bunkers, and then effectively tied into the tee. And we were trying to get out to the tree line as wide as we could, but people talked about it being like an Augusta rough type of thing. And so we did. Davis came out that summer, and I showed him what we're up to, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, I think this is kind of, it's different, but let's go with it." And then as we were getting closer to 2012, he said, "You know, I don't know. I'm kind of not sure about it." And I said, "Well, from our perspective, it's better to be short and have you say, you know, 2-3 weeks out, let's grow it up, than the other way around."
Yeah.
And the club was on board. And so
I bet members loved it. It's probably the easiest course three's ever been.
Yeah, right. It was. I mean, it was, you know, you could miss a fairway and you had a, you know, for a higher handicapper, it was a great lie.
Yeah.
You know, so we worked hard at that and got that all cut in, and we started just the greens had just been built in 2009-10. And so they were maturing like we were talking about, and we were running a lot of play through them. We had a lot of rain and heat, and you know, so it was struggle. We struggled to get them to kind of knit in and solidify, but you know, they got better as time went on, and ultimately they got there, and they're structurally they're fantastic, and they've never blinked. But it was a longer road for those greens to get there. But by the time we got to 12, which was effectively their second full year, they were steady, and we were able to get those green speeds up. So, you know, as it got, you know, within, you know, a few weeks of the event, Davis and Steve Stricker and I went out, and we picked five hole locations on all the greens. Mm-hmm. And we didn't say, hey, Friday a.m., Saturday p.m., Sunday, or on that. We just, Davis wanted too easy, too hard, and you know, one in the middle kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you had like A, B, C, D, E.
Right. And we handed those over to Kerry Haig, who in the end is, you know, the final decision maker on all that. And he edited a few of them right off the bat. Like, you guys are nuts, way too hard, not doing this. And it was his call. And he ultimately...
Way too hard in the sense of, like, they wanted, you know, excitement.
Birdies. Yeah, they wanted excitement, and they were a little too close to slopes. And, uh-huh. You know, just, you know, he made a comment like, you guys are going to... trying to get me fired with these, or what, you know?
Yeah.
And we just laughed, but you know, in the end, those decisions were Kerry's, and you know, he, like I said, he used the ones that he wanted to use. And people talk about Sunday 17 on Sunday, and you know, being on the
where right, was it,
it
right,
was on the
back
right,
right,
yeah, back right, and you know, like, why Davis put the pin there. And first of all, I don't know if Davis and Kerry had a conversation and said, do that or not. You know, maybe they did. That wasn't, I was executing the management of the grounds by that point. I wasn't involved in hole locations.
It's amazing how everybody looks at that pin. Yeah. When it, like, you could, there's a bunch of others. Like, no one would ever pick out the fourth hole pin. Like, it could have been the worst one of all of them for, like, the team.
Right.
But no one ever would zoom in on the fourth hole because it's the fourth hole. Everybody might have lost the fourth hole.
I know.
But because it's at the end, somebody right. zooms in on the 17th.
Well, I'm with you. You know, I mean, historically, the United States had been weakest in the first 2 days of the event, the four ball and the foursomes. And Davis created a strategy, and we had a golf course set up that he handed the team a 4-point lead going into their strongest event.
Yeah.
And then they just got beat. So hole locations are not, you know, they got outplayed that day.
Yeah. And you were about to pop open the champagne.
Yeah, I was, yeah. Yeah, I was.
What did you do, like, the night after you were done? Like,
That, you know what? That, I'll never forget that, because, you know, what a family goes through, you know.
Yeah.
If you're married, I had young daughters at the time. I mean, what they went through to support me to be able to do that was a lot. And they gave up a ton of time and a lot of things in life for me to be so dedicated. And, you know, I was fortunate to spend that night with them. And we had a little pizza party down here, and volunteers and people were leaving and all that kind of thing. But, you know, the four of us just got in a cart and we went up to the clubhouse and we walked through, we went in the team rooms, we talked to all the players and went into the press tent. And my girls got a picture with Rory McIlroy, and I got a picture with Jose Maria holding the Ryder Cup. And, you know, I talked to Davis too. He was, you know, he was bummed out. It was obviously a totally different deal over there, but we spent our evening just kind of around town. I mean, they were partied up. That you're partied up there till 1 or 2 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we were up there just, you know, kind of walking around, being a part of it all.
Yeah.
So and the next morning, I mean, literally the next morning at 7 a.m., Ryan Schneider was here.
Uh-huh.
Wadsworth was here. We had equipment staged. The next morning we took about 70 trees out, and Brian and Eric Iverson had bulldozed 2 greens and already rough shaped them out by the end of the day on Monday. So, I mean, we had no time to you know, think too much
on
about
to the next
it. Yeah, we were on to the next thing, you know, and fortunate to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Were there any players that were, like, particularly interested, like, ask you more questions than other ones?
Yeah, Jason Duffner.
Really?
He was great. Well, a number of them came out early with Davis and played a practice round, and that was really cool for me. Davis asked me to come along and just ride with them. And so I would go out into the landing zone, see how far they were hitting it, you know, just making sure everything was good out there, you know, get up to the green, watch them hit in. And I went all 18 holes with them. We talked green speeds, different things, and that was a lot of fun. But Jason Duffner wanted to know about heights of cut, and I mean, he's converting fractions of decimals just off the top of his head and being right, you know, which, you know, I need a calculator for that, you know. So I mean, he really
You wouldn't expect Duffner to be that calculating and I feel like he would be like a go with the flow guy.
He had all kinds of questions, and it was interesting. And
I wonder if he asked that for everybody, you know, every event.
I don't know. He didn't say much. He just asked a question. We told him the answer. He asked another one. But you know, it was really interesting. And I mean, all the guys on both teams were just fantastic to our team, and really gave us real big nods of support and recognition through that event, which, you know, they certainly didn't need to do by any means, and we feel real fortunate and blessed that they did so. You know, it was just kind of a solidification of a job well done to have the players say good things.
What do you think they would want to do different with the course setup if they could do it all over again?
Man, it's a good question. I'd have to ask them, because they were loving it, obviously, and then all of a sudden it just like flipped on them.
I think that was just a golf thing. You could stack everything in your favor and the other team can win, you know? Sports.
Yeah, you know, they liked the fact that they could hit it, use their length and hit it a long way and not get themselves in too much trouble. So I mean, they saw
the same thing at Hazeltine with that place had like no rough.
Yeah.
Middle pins. It was great when Justin Rose was complaining about par, like too easy.
Yeah, exactly.
But I can understand that. Sure. So you got PGA here, like, or not PGA, BMW.
Yeah.
You're kind of got to be starting to get ready for that now.
We are. It really kicked in when we went and spent some time with Connor Healy and the team up at Conway Farms.
Yeah.
And Connor's a great guy. He ran a fantastic operation.
Place was in great shape.
Yeah, it was just immaculate. His tournament execution was superb. And so I was really fortunate. He went out of his way to he and Paul Vermeulen from the PGA Tour went out of their way to make the place accessible to me and make, you know, give me insight into whatever it is that I needed to see and that I was interested in seeing. So, to your point, it just got the juices flowing a little bit, you know, tournament mode back, and it's really nice to be there with the grandstands up and feel that atmosphere, and I look forward to it. And for the guys that are on our team now that weren't here to run the Ryder Cup, I really look forward to going through an event with them, because that's, you know, the whole journey, the lead up to it is really, you know, working together to get there is really what it's all about. And then, you know, those 4 days of the event are really special too.
But they go by like this.
Yeah, it's like a wedding.
Yeah, I was just going to compare that. I feel like you just got married,
so you know, your head's spinning. You after you're like, hey, did I talk to that guy? Did I do this? You know, you can't remember, but that's kind of what it's like. But in the end, if you're prepared, it all works out.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if I was prepared for my wedding, but it worked out.
Right,
got through it. So.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's interesting. It'll be a little bit different of a setup. It'll be a little tougher. But the great thing about number three, there's so much space for infrastructure.
Right.
That was you can put a grandstand and it's not a backboard.
Right.
And I mean, like 18 at Koepka banked it off the back. That was unbelievable. But the one nice thing is it's up. How close do you try and push those grandstands up?
You know,
because you want the fans as close as you can, but
right,
you don't want to affect the integrity of the tournament.
Yeah, you know, what was interesting is Carrie said something to me when we were doing the Ryder Cup was that. You know, he wanted wide ropes and wide corridors because the further he could spread it out, the more people could see.
Yeah.
As opposed to pulling it tight, you know, with those size crowds.
Yeah. Well, and so few golfers.
So few golfers, exactly. And so, you know, I have yet to see the layout from the Western Golf Association and the folks at the PGA Tour with regards to what we're going to do. So I don't know. Looking at what they did at Conway, they had it really tight. Our number 18 doesn't lend itself because of the elevated green to get too close like they did there. We gotta be a little further back. 17 has a natural amphitheater anyway. I think that, you know, for the Ryder Cup, we use that. I hope they do that again. But, you know, we'll see what they come up with. I know that for the Ryder Cup, we built 43 acres of stuff. So back of the house, front of the house, 43 acres was all part of that infrastructure. And I think the estimate for the BMW is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 15. So it's about really one-third the size of what the Ryder Cup was.
Any, like, weird little thing go wrong during the Ryder Cup week? Like did you have any, like, mini disaster that no one would know about? You know, like, or some machine broke?
So every superintendent's worst nightmare was about 10 days before the event, we had a hydraulic leak right up the center of three fairway on a fairway unit. And we were like, we all just kind of standing there. I mean, because we had taken every precaution. Yeah. To not have that happen, and it happened, and there it was. And so I'm thinking, you know, what are we going to do about this? So we've got, you know, basically POA bent fairways out there, you know, predominantly bent, but there's enough POA in them that they're not pure bent. So siding it with bent would have been a sore thumb. You know, you would have seen it. So we thought about it, and the guy that works for us, his name is Sal Garcia, and he's just a master craftsman, and we've been working together for 20-some years. He's gone with me from site to site, but we went to the forward tee on number four that had a very similar turf stand, stripped it completely, patched that hydraulic leak right up the gut, and then sodded that tee over with bent. They weren't going to use it for the event, yeah. And nobody looks at the forward tee. And so he put it in there, and he threaded it in there like as good as you could possibly do it. No, and I mean, you know, we could see it, but I didn't know if anybody else was going to see it. And so about 4 days later or so, I'm standing on the third green, and here comes a golf cart just running right down the fairway, and he's literally driving this hydraulic leak line. And it's Paul Azinger. And he's scouting the golf course for TV coverage. And he pulls right up to me, and I had met him once before, and he says hello, and he's like, man, the golf course is fantastic. It's immaculate. Congratulations, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking,
thank God.
They're never going to see it. They're never going to know. Nobody's going to know. And nobody did, you know. So that was you know, yeah, that was enough last minute to put your heart in your throat. But
my wedding day, I cut my neck shaving.
You did.
And it just a tiny one. I never cut myself shaving ever in my life before that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't have that, whatever that kit thing is, because I've never cut myself shaving. And I had a white shirt, and it, like, some of it got on the collar because it, like, started bleeding again.
Yeah.
I mean, I freaked out, but, like, I was in there with, like, a toothbrush, like, you know.
Right.
But eventually it came out. Nobody noticed. I mean, you can't even see him in the photos.
Right. Good. Good.
But yeah, it's like same kind of thing.
Same thing,
yeah,
for sure.
Just things that go wrong.
Yeah.
So if you were going to make one change to, I mean, you got two relatively new golf courses and three, what would you make? One, if you could make one change out here, you know, you're putting on you're the czar of Medina. All the members answer to you.
I see.
What would you do from a golf course perspective?
You know, I would make some adjustments to some of the bunkering on course three, and we're gonna replace the sand, and we're gonna do some slight regrading just from sand buildup prior to the BMW. But there were some bunkers that were built when the course was heavily treed, and we've taken 1,400 trees off that golf course and since we've been here. And now you have some bunker complexes that they still work. You know, for all intents and purposes, they're fine. Mm-hmm. But just because I know that there used to be a support wall of trees that defined that shaping parameters, I think that with those gone, I would soften those and shift those a little bit to be respectful. You know, just
so you shift them out a little.
I'd blend the tie-ins out. You know, you've got some real steep toes the slope on the backsides. I'd fade those, and I'd push the bunkers in play a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, bring the fairway a little bit more into them. Just from the experience that I've been fortunate to have, watching Tom and Brian and Eric do that stuff, and then getting to really direct a lot of it on two and so forth. You know, I have the confidence now to think I could improve them. That might be bad, but that's probably what I would do.
Hey, confidence is half the battle.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Just like golf. If you're not confident, you're not going to have a good shot.
True, very true.
You're not confident, you're probably build a bad bunker.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Now, there's a couple of them out there that I would love to get the green light on, but...
Yeah. It seems like everybody loves the mowing lines right into bunkers.
Yeah.
Is there any thought of ever trying to get some of that on three?
Oh, man, you know, I would love to see that. I think that if you embarked on that, however,
you have to change the lips.
You got to do it everywhere. The problem is if you did that, and what I mean, I don't mean every single hole, but what I mean is every hole would have to be evaluated, and
yeah,
every bunker would have to be shifted to make it work, because right now they're shaped and built into the fairway in ways that wouldn't lend itself to make it look natural.
Yeah,
and so we'd have to shift.
It'd be a big project.
It'd be a big project. There'd be bulldozers, mini X's, and you know, some grading would definitely need to happen. But it'd be good. I think that course would toughen up that way. You know, it's an interesting golf course. It's so long. It's so penal if you get offline.
Dude, if you don't drive it well, you're toast.
Yeah. It's like going 15 rounds with a heavyweight. You know, for you know, 13, 14 handicapper like myself, it's like, man, breaking 90 is like I'm buying the beers. You know what I mean? Because it's just a long day. And, you know.
I hadn't played it in a while.
Yeah.
And I played it after my honeymoon, so I hadn't touched a club. It was
okay.
The first round out after my honey. I think I hadn't touched a club in like 16 days. And like, I started out okay. I hit it pretty good, but then I like kind of lost my tempo. And like, it was like for like five holes, like I was getting bludgeoned over the head.
Right, exactly.
But it's like, I mean, you can't fake it out there, and that's why it's a championship course. Like, nobody can slap it around and shoot a good score on that golf course.
Very true.
But
very true.
It could, I mean, the land is unbelievable over there, and the oaks are so beautiful because they got so many big oaks. And
right.
You can see them more now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the topography gets really, really good on holes like 12. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
is that the par four that goes?
Yeah, that big sweeping side fairway. I mean, you know, that's, you hear about Augusta, people have never been, and then you go and you're like, wow, they're right. You can't appreciate the topography unless you're there. 12 has that kind of size to it.
What was that green before the changes like?
It was pretty much, it was about two thirds the size. It was pretty much back to front.
With a little this way?
With a little bit towards the lake, but the approach, the whole right side of the green was all rough.
Uh-huh.
It had a little hump in it. So we cut that hump out, smoothed it out, brought that fairway around the side, and then put some movement into it. And it's got this really, right now it's got this really nice swale that runs off the back that visually looks like, you know, disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing how it plays, the miss there is actually, if that pin's back there, it's long because it'll stay up.
Mm-hmm.
It will run through that and stay up.
Short's a disaster.
Short's a disaster. And
like, even on the
think,
front part of the green, that putt is brutal
it
going
is
up.
Brutal. It's, yeah, it is.
I had it the last time I played it. I thought I hit a really good shot and it grabbed and came back down that ridge. And it
right.
was not a good spot to be
yeah.
at all. It's,
I know.
That's it. It's a beautiful golf hole.
Yeah, and from there it continues to get interesting with 14s. You know, got this rolling shoot through those trees, and then 16, which is such a fantastic golf hole. Now that it's got the length back, it's for the top level players. It's really fantastic.
How do you? I noticed. I imagine, and I saw the members just end up in that bottom part so much. Like, that's got to be just a huge traffic area for you.
It is. Yeah.
How do you? And you guys get so many rounds at three. I mean, it's booked.
Right.
How do you manage areas like that? Like, do you have a strategy towards them?
Yeah, so from a purely maintenance standpoint, what we do is rather than painting ground under repair with white paint, mm-hmm. we tack rope down on the ground and circle it as if it were paint in white rope, put a sign on there, ground under repair, and we put drop areas off in the intermediate cut, and we do that for outings on Mondays, and we do it for like most heavy active guest play days, Monday through Thursday. Mm-hmm. And then when we start to gravitate more to our member play on Friday afternoon, Saturday, and Sunday, we pull it.
Okay.
And that way, most people that land down in there, you know, and a lot of guys that are here just playing, unless they're a really great golfer, are going to choose to take it, put it on a fluffier lie to hit that that pitch back up that hill. And it saves on divots. So that's how we do it from a maintenance standpoint. We've looked and we've tried to put a little bit of movement in there to move balls away.
And the water probably sits down there a little bit more too, which is...
When we did the greens project, what we did to firm that bottom up was we excavated that entire bottom area out 6 inches, capped it with sand, and put subsurface drainage in it. So it stays a little firmer.
Uh-huh.
But we looked at closing the fairway off and making it rough. This was all...
That would have been good.
Yeah, these were all ideas pitched at Reese. Yeah. You know, putting a bunker right in there. And Reese just held firm, like, hey, Curtis, you got to come up with a way to fill these divots and get them to grow because I don't want to change it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that was his position because I think that the hole's better that way. And
just watch balls roll back down to your feet that way.
That's right, yeah.
That's the worst feeling in golf.
Yeah, that's right.
Can't get rid of that.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we do this overrated, underrated segment.
Okay.
So you got a pick. So we're going to go from the way Medina members perceive the course.
Okay.
And we're going to go through each of the courses, overrated, underrated, and you have to pick.
Okay.
So course number one.
The way, from the perspective of the Medina members.
The greater, the average Medina member.
Underrated.
Yeah, that's why I heard it. Yeah. People don't understand those greens, right?
Yeah, you hear some of that these days. You know, it's still busy. They're still playing it. We got plenty of guest rounds, but you know, there's a few greens out there that I think are great, but they challenge people, and they're not. That design is unique. It fits the lay of the land, it fits the site, but it's different. And I think that's what is the hardest thing for them to accept.
It's amazing how
changes
in just any aspect of society is like frightening for people.
And this is a tough segment for me because, you know, having built all these three, they're like my, I feel like a part of me's, you know, they're like my kids in a lot of ways, you know. So I mean, it's picking one kid over the other.
I had Tom on. I think he said you might have said overrated to everything I said just because that's his personality.
Well, I definitely think that in the last 12 months, let's just say, course one has gotten some inaccurate criticism, and I think that it's underrated.
I bet if you explained some of those greens, I bet there's some bumps that people could play off of. And it's one of the things I think is people don't understand strategy when it's different, when it's not just center of the fairway, center of the green. Like, you know,
that's right.
Three is really right in front of you, and that one probably has a lot more subtlety and a little bit more thought in positioning. Like, if you're over on the right side of this fairway and the pin's here, like, don't hit it at the pin, hit it like 20 feet left and it'll probably filter all the way in. Once you do it once though, you see that happens. Like, I think there needs to be like a guide or something sometimes,
you know. And we've got, there's a lot of short grass, so you know, you've got to learn to kind of bump and run and play a tight pitch, and that's not typical either. You know, and so I think that, you know, when I played with Tom on opening day, he chipped all over that golf course with a 7-iron all day long.
That's all he hit.
Yeah, and very effectively.
Yeah.
You know, and I was wondering, is he making a point with this? Is that what he's trying to, like, get this across to those of us playing with him that this is how you should do it? But, hey, you know, the more I hear some of the things people don't like, the more I think they ought to approach it with that strategy a little more.
So I played with him, and I was hitting I had a shot, and I was short, and he looked at me, he goes, "You hit a lob wedge here?" And I go, "Yeah." So, like, and he goes, "You don't even think?" I'm like, "Yeah, this is what I would say 90% of, like, good amateur player, like tournament amateur players would hit this shot." He goes, "You would never hit like an 8-iron?" So, like, I hit that, and I hit an 8-iron, and I was like, "Wow, that was really easy." Right. And, like, I've started to hit more of those shots since, because it never even came to my mind to use the ground. But he uses it everywhere. Like, he hits shots like you're, like, I would never think about hitting a 7-iron. He hits it, and he's like, "Yeah, you see the ground goes this way and comes back, so you know it's just going to go right to the..." It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, he's got it down, though, that's for sure.
Yeah. It's people just need to experiment more.
Yeah, definitely.
So, course two.
You know, that's a hard one to, you know... It might be too soon, I think.
I feel like there's a buzz.
There's definitely a buzz. You know, the tee sheet is filling up as the summer has gone on every month to a higher level. We haven't had anybody not in, say they don't like something about it. I played it a couple times myself. I love playing it. So I don't know. We'll have to see, you know. I mean, it's really been a great complement to the other two, and that's what it was intended to be, and that makes Medina's members' portfolio just, I think, stand apart. But in terms of a golf course, a core golf course, we need a little more time.
What about that course, like, are you most proud of? Since it's the most recent, you know, rebuild, renovation,
right.
Restoration, really.
Well, you know, I'm most proud of how we were able to brighten the original shaping that came out in a way that looked natural. That we were able to modernize things where applicable, brighten and restore things where applicable, and make it look like it's been there for a while, and it doesn't look like we moved dirt to do anything, and that was the goal, and I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, it's cool. I love that place.
Thank you.
It's like more. Need more of that, especially at, like, I mean, I feel like more Chicago courses should be like that, because, like, I always say this to clubs, and, like, you're actually one of the clubs that can do the hard golf, because I always say to, like, you know, people at clubs, it's like, all right, so, like, you're in Chicago, like, why are you trying to be the hardest golf course in Chicago? Like, you're never going to be it when you got Medina, Butler, Medina 3, right. Butler,
right.
And Olympia Fields. Like, you're never going to be as hard as those three golf courses.
Yeah.
So, like, why are you trying to make your golf course hard? Why don't you try and make your golf course, like, the most fun golf course in Chicago?
Right.
And, like, number two is a perfect example of it being, like, the most fun. Like, it's, you know, you got drivable holes. You got short par threes. You got longer par threes. You hit like, almost all the clubs in your bag.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
And the bunkering's beautiful. I mean, like, the way you guys have those mowing lines rolling in, it's definitely a modern product of, like, what kind of, like, the trends of the industry, mm-hmm. I imagine, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That was what we were shooting for. So it's good to hear you say that.
Yeah, it's cool. I recommend it. Anybody that gets the chance to play, too, it's fun. I heard a lot of buzz. I was really skeptical. I'm not the biggest Reese fan.
Yeah.
And I was skeptical, but then right. I played. I saw it. I was like, wow, that was really good.
Yeah.
I had to.
You know, Reese needs to be credited for on that project, for sure, among other things, is is the fact that, you know, he let it happen. He showed up and when we started doing stuff and working that stuff, the more different it got, the weirder it got, the further away from what he had done before it got, the more excited he got, the more he encouraged it to keep going.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was fantastic. You know, I wasn't sure how he was going to embrace this approach that was going to happen. And when we had talked about it, but when we started doing it, I wasn't sure how much he was going to do that. And he absolutely did. I mean, he got so excited that he kept, I mean, we had a plan in terms of his number of visits and stuff like that. And like, he blew that budget because he just kept wanting to come back. You know, and he liked it so much. So I give him a ton of credit for his, you know, his ability to see it differently and to put it on the ground.
It's what people need to do with number one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Embrace exactly. The change. Embrace the difference.
That's right. That's exactly right.
All
right,
last one, number three.
All right, so we talked about it being long and challenging. You got to drive the ball straight. So But I'm going to say underrated. And I'm going to say it from a perspective of a Medina member because it's, from a Medina member's perspective, it might be a bit overrated.
I just switched. I was going to ask
from
you.
From my perspective,
I was
going to
ask you, what's one thing
I forgot the
you're
rules.
Say.
I forgot the rules. All right. So from my perspective, it's underrated. I think it has a lot of, from the right set of tees, it has a lot of shot values. It's got some fantastic strategic elements. It forces you to think from the right set of tees based on your skill level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that would apply to you from further back than it would for me.
Yeah, I bet a lot of people play the wrong tees.
Right, and from a Medina member's perspective, you know, they put, you know, in their defense, it's always been the one that was the flagship.
It's got to be the hard course.
Yeah, it was the flagship for them. It holds all the tournaments, the history. So it's, you know, from their standpoint, you know, I think they overrated it a bit because that was the one that was always the one that was kind of carrying the torch, pulling the rest of the club along.
Mm-hmm.
And now the club's much different than it was 10 years ago. And, you know, maybe that perspective from there will change for them.
Yeah. I think it's okay though. Like I wrote about Olympia Fields last year and like, you know, going there and playing, like you're playing a hard golf course.
Yeah.
And right. Hard is okay. Like if I was a member, I'd play three here probably like 2 times out of 10, maybe 1 out of 10.
Yeah.
I don't need to go get my ass kicked for like 5 hours that often, but right. It's good to go do it every once in a while.
Right.
But that's the beauty of having, if you, like, that's what I really like about here and Olympia Fields is like, if you have a really good golf course and you have like the South course at Olympia Fields is a lot of fun. And these two courses are a lot of fun, 1 and 2. So it's like, why, you know, you don't have to play the really hard course every time, but
right.
Like that's a, you know,
yeah.
People complain about Medina, you know, oh, it's so long and hard. It's like, what did you expect? It's
right.
A major championship golf course.
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
There's some other, I think Mo Lyons could be better. Like, but like, that's like, I mean, that's just that.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But like if the complaint of it's long and hard is like, well, it's a PGA Championship golf course.
Yeah, like the answer to that is, yeah, you're right. You know,
that's what it's supposed to be.
Exactly.
It's not
exactly.
So, yeah. So,
yeah.
But thanks for coming on. This was fun.
All right, yeah, it was a blast. I really appreciate it. And I love the work you're doing and really appreciate your, bringing the different sides of the industry out to the world of golf and keep it up, man. Really appreciate it.
It's interesting. I get interested. I want to know as much as I can know, you know?
Yeah, it's awesome, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.